Welcome to Scope It Out. In this edition, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Andrew Thambu on his article, The Functional and Psychological Burden of Empty Nose Syndrome. Scope It Out is made possible by support from FIAGON and Karl Storz Endoscopy America.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm happy to be joined by Dr. Andrew Thambu from Vancouver, British Columbia. We will be discussing his article entitled The Functional and Psychological Burden of Empty Nose Syndrome. This is currently available online in early view at the website of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of those topics I think we all want to know more about and understand better. And it's interesting, you and a few other folks around the country have really taken this disorder and our understanding of this disorder to another level. So we certainly thank you for that. I read your article with a lot of interest, having been interested in the comorbidity of depression associated with chronic rhinosinusitis previously. It seems that there's quite a lot of psychological burden in this disorder.
Definitely.
Let's start here, though. How do we know when a patient has, what is empty nose syndrome, and what are the diagnostic criteria for empty nose syndrome? Maybe start and give us a little background there.
Yeah, definitely. You know, initially, I'd like to first say, thanks to you, Tim, and also my co-authors, Jamil Manji and Dr. Nayak, and he's well known for empty nose syndrome, especially among his American colleagues and internationally now as well. We came up with a diagnostic criteria for empty nose syndrome, and we kind of based it on kind of chronic sinusitis. So chronic sinusitis, we kind of have these subjective and objective findings, and we kind of put that together to help us have a diagnosis for chronic sinusitis. We thought we'd kind of go with that kind of criteria for empty nose syndrome. So Dr. Nayak and I were seeing a lot of these patients at Stanford, and they all had a particular symptoms that were all in keeping with each other. And we thought, hey, are there subjective symptoms that all these patients complained about? One thing that we noticed was that these patients complained of particular symptoms surrounding dryness, airflow, suffocation, feeling too open, crusting, and burning. This was adapted from a previous questionnaire called the SNOT 28. So we took those symptoms as I described and kind of validated a subjective questionnaire, which we called the ENS6Q. And that was
right.
One of the papers that we did a couple of years
ago. And that publication, I think, is also in the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
And I think in 2017 it was one of the top clinical papers.
Yeah, relatively recent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we have this group of patient symptoms that seem to correlate with the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so what are the clinical...
Sorry to jump in. I mean, there's with that questionnaire, there was a high sensitivity and specificity in identifying those patients.
Okay.
And then, as you're kind of alluding to here, what are the the objective measures that we kind of came up with? Stephen Hauser established a test called the cotton test. Essentially, that test involved placing cotton within the inferior meatus and kind of creating the bulk of a pseudo inferior turbinate, and you would see how patient symptoms changed. And what we did was we used the cotton test done by Dr. Hauser and just figured out a scoring system based on the ENS6Q that said a minimal clinical difference was required to make a diagnosis of empty nose syndrome as well. With the ENS6Q, we found that a change of 7 points on the ENS6Q was indicative of empty nose syndrome. So that was the measure.
So if you perform the cotton test and the patient has this improvement on the quality of life instrument, then that's also helpful in the diagnosis. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. So we're looking at a subjective measure, so a positive ENS6Q, which is 11 points or more, and a positive objective test, which is the cotton test.
Okay. And then clinically, in your experience, what do these patients look like when you see their examination, I guess, in the clinic? What does their nose look like typically to you?
A majority of the patients have their inferior turbinates resected, and they could have a various nature of that, obviously, as well. They can have just even a soft tissue reduction of their inferior turbinates, which may have been done, you know, appropriately, like a majority of us would do, but unfortunately they have some symptoms of ENS, or they can have other structures that have been removed, such as the middle turbinate.
Got it. And so most commonly, in your clinical experience, what is the most common appearance of empty nose syndrome? I mean, what characteristics do you look for in the nose where you would say, oh gosh, this is particularly associated? Yes.
Yeah, well, obviously some kind of soft tissue loss of a structure that, you know, usually should be there. So inferior turbinates, middle turbinates, et cetera. However, you also notice in these patients, they get these hypertrophic tissues in areas that they're trying to compensate for this tissue loss. So we looked at a study where we looked at CT scans of all these empty nose patients and looked at soft tissue growth. And what we appreciated was areas like the inferior meatus, the nasal floor, even the septum, like at the level where the inferior turbinate was, the posterior septum, areas where, you know, on the contralateral side, there was some tissue before, there was tissue growth that was recreated. What's interesting is that all these areas where there was tissue growth, it's very different from, like, the inferior turbinate. You know, the inferior turbinate has this kind of erectile tissue nature versus where on the inferior meatus or the septum inferiorly or even the nasal floor, you don't have that kind of erectile tissue nature. And you know, these patients, I hypothesize that they have an inability to compensate, drastic changes in weather. Because unlike us who have inferior turbinates, you know, who can compensate due to weather changes, they can't.
Got it. So my experience has been when I see these patients in the clinic and I look in their nose, it's got to be the vast majority of the time is a total or subtotal resection of the inferior turbinates, meaning it's not subtle. It is a near total resection of the inferior turbinates. And I have to say that I'm not sure I've seen what I would have classified as a patient with empty nose syndrome in someone who's received a less, I guess, aggressive resection of those tissues. But you're saying that you've seen some patients where simply soft tissue, a conservative soft tissue reduction of the inferior turbinate, such as a, let's say, microdebrider technique or some form of electrosurgical reduction of the inferior turbinate, still results in symptoms of empty nose syndrome.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. You know, majority, I would say 90% plus, are in this area of like subtotal resection or total resection. But yeah, you know, I think there have been some patients that I've seen with, especially my time at Stanford, where we did see patients with some degree of just soft tissue reduction and unfortunately had those symptoms.
And in the patients who have the total resection, near total resection, I call it, of the inferior turbinates, when you see this compensatory tissue develop, it develops along the nasal septum or along the floor of the nasal cavity, almost in an attempt to reproduce the inferior turbinate?
That's correct, yeah, or the inferior meatus as well. Like, so it's kind of like a neoturbinate in a way.
Yeah, I've not seen that, I don't think. But maybe I don't know what I'm looking for, but I don't recall seeing that specifically in these patients. What does it look like?
It looks like hypertrophic tissue. I mean, it just looks like overgrowth tissue, and it's trying to take over that space. It's in areas where it's usually it's on the contralateral side, and usually it's on the septum, and it's usually taking over the space where the inferior turbinate used to be.
Right, right. The other thing I've noticed is that the middle turbinate has been implicated in this disease process over the years. But I've found that in the patients where I've seen empty nose syndrome clinically, I mean, in my experience, it's really the inferior turbinate, meaning, yes, they may have also had their middle turbinate resected, but what they all have in common is, in my experience, is this drastic resection of the inferior turbinate. So that's the turbinate that I felt like, well, gosh, we have to be particularly careful with the inferior turbinate.
I agree as well. I think it, the indeterminate aspect of this condition is rare. It's just, you know, your alarms go off when people have certain symptoms that they describe, and you see that their middle turbinate, pardon me, has been resected. But yeah, again, I agree with you. I think 99% of these patients are pretty much an inferior turbinate kind of resection.
In your study, what you really found was an incredible psychological burden associated with this disease process. Can you describe that to our listeners a bit?
When it comes to this condition of empty nose syndrome, you know, a lot of people, are we still, we're not sure about this condition. And one aspect of it that people allude to, people with these symptoms, is having, you know, this being more of a psychological problem. I thought it was really important to put the study together and looking at global patients and really quantifying how these patients, like the degree of these patients are suffering. We kind of say that these patients are depressed, they have anxiety, they have poor sleep, they have a poor quality of life. So we thought we could put validated questionnaires that are out there towards these patients to have them fill them in. So we had them fill in the PHQ-9, which is called the 9-item patient health questionnaire, and that's for depression. We had them fill in a 7-item general anxiety disorder questionnaire for anxiety. For sleep, they did the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. In terms of just get a sense of their work productivity, there was another validated questionnaire that we used called the Work Productivity and Impairment Questionnaire. And
okay.
Just for general quality of life, we did the EQ-5.
And just to kind of cut to the chase, what you really found was substantial impact on all of these facets of the human condition based on empty nose syndrome. Patients with empty nose syndrome. So then the question, it begs the question, I guess it's the chicken or egg question, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
did patients begin with some higher psychological burden and then they were exposed to this resection of the turbinate, which then uncovered an even greater psychological burden in this patient population? Or did the resection of the turbinates and the empty nose syndrome then spawn all of these issues? And so what do we know about that?
Yeah, so, obviously, it looks at association, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't really address the chicken-egg question. However, we're actually about to present a paper at the Triologic, this upcoming COSM. We're looking at the impact of doing inferior turbinate augmentation in these patients with empty nose and seeing how their scores, like, for example, on depression, anxiety, et cetera, have changed.
Yeah.
We see a significant drop in their depression, anxiety levels after inferior turbinate augmentation. So that gives us a hint, at least, that this condition was the result of the chicken egg, the egg being the surgery. You know, it's funny, before I even went to the States from Canada, even up here in Vancouver, we actually thought, I was taught that these patients were kind of crazy too. You know, I had that impression. And then I went to Stanford and was surprised that I actually saw people that were pilots that had regular jobs and, you know, they talk about a history of having these inferior turbinates resected and their whole life being changed. You know, it's hard to get a feeling of their baseline, but my intuition was that, you know, they didn't have a sense of depression or anxiety. And that's what this condition kind of, I got intrigued by this condition.
Yeah.
And then I just saw when, you know, Dr. Nyack performed these surgeries of inferior turbinate augmentations, their sense of depression, anxiety, the sense of sleep all got better. And that's where we started putting all these measures together and trying to quantify the impact on ENS patients and the impact of doing inferior augmentation.
That's a very interesting point you bring up, and I appreciate your honesty about your impression in this patient population, because I think over the years, this patient population has really been very, very misunderstood. We as clinicians would see patients who had, let's say, tumor surgery of the nose and sinuses, where they had dramatic resections, intranasal resections of their inferior turbinates, perhaps of many more structures than that, and yet they showed no evidence of what we're now calling empty nose syndrome. And yet, then you'd see another patient who really, they've had their inferior turbinates resected, and I would say that in my practice, you know, the top echelon of patients who are impacted by their disease process several of those patients are who I would classify as patients with empty nose syndrome. So it can have a very, very dramatic impact. And I think it's been difficult for clinicians to reconcile, okay, so how come we can do this dramatic resection with tumor surgery and really not see any symptoms? And then we take another patient where they've had their inferior turbinates resected nearly completely, and they can have such a dramatic disease process that unfolds.
I agree, and I see that in my clinical practice as well. And I think, you know, this isn't me hypothesizing, but I do believe a cancer patient and someone coming in for chronic sinus disease and is coming in for two different goals, you know. And I think mm-hmm. patient that gets cancer surgery has an expectation that they may have some symptoms that they're just stuck with, and an expectation that they had sinusal surgery and they're stuck with such symptoms thereafter, and they don't come complaining to us, versus people who have chronic sinus disease come complaining of wanting a better quality of life. They don't attain that baseline that they want. Moreover, I also think even in the population of people who get chronic sinus disease, and they do get, some people get inferior turbinate resections, some don't, and only a small percentage do get this condition. We're still trying to figure that out, right? I again, hypothesize, and as well as Dr. Nayak and a few others across the country, feel that this is more of a healing process disorder, mm-hmm. that there's just some patients that don't heal differently, the nerves don't function as well as some others.
Right, right. And it's interesting that you bring up healing, because every once in a while, I feel like I've had a relatively simple, not a cure, but a significant improvement in the condition. And I'll describe that patient scenario. The patient may be months status post resection of the inferior turbinates, and they will come into the clinic with complaints that are very consistent with empty nose syndrome. And on my endoscopic examination, on occasion, I found a portion of bone, of the inferior conchal bone, that is sticking out of the mucosa that has otherwise healed. Mm-hmm. And it's exposed bone, it's necrotic, it's dead bone, based on my experience. But I found that if I grasp that with a Blakesley forceps and I remove that spicule, sometimes there are several spicules of bone right along that resection site. When I remove those spicules of bone, it then allows the mucosa to heal over that bone. And I feel like on a couple of occasions that has solved the problem for that particular patient. Now that doesn't solve the problem for everyone, all of these patients by a long shot. But have you seen that clinical scenario play out before?
I haven't seen that clinical scenario yet. But I think we're all talking about simple things, as like people, that something's being irritated, you know, some form of the trigeminal nerve. And that's why we look at, you know, computational flow dynamic studies and trying to get an understanding by, you know, recreating inferior turbinates. You know, we're not recreating nerve function.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're not recreating normal mucosa, but we're redistributing flow to other parts of the trigeminal nerve within the nasal mucosa, so people get a sense of airflow, etc. So maybe that's what they're experiencing in your situation.
Yeah, these patients that I've seen and just described they seem to be more bothered by the crusting that's occurring.
Definitely.
And then once you remove that necrotic bone, the crusting then resolves in that group of patients. And for whatever reason, that was the part of the healing process that was bogging them down. But others are very, very well healed. There's no necrotic bone to be seen. There may not, in my experience, there's not even dramatic crusting in this patient population. It seems to be more of a condition where they simply can't sense the airflow through their nose. And so they feel like their nose is completely obstructed, or they'll describe a certain suffocation that occurs. Those are the more classic symptoms I've seen in my practice.
Exactly. Us as well.
Okay, so then you bring up this idea that given the functional and psychological burden, if there are a way to treat both the physical manifestations of empty nose syndrome and the psychological manifestations of the disease process, that we might actually optimize our outcomes in this patient population.
Yeah, I definitely think so. You know, it's funny. We looked at this condition very much like tinnitus.
Yeah.
You know, attentiveness, you know, we all, as clinicians, don't hear it. We can't hear what the patient's feeling. But we recognize that it does exist, and one aspect in the treatment is some kind of hearing aid to mask it. So that's what we're kind of doing with this inferior turbinate augmentation. We're not recreating a real turbinate. We're creating an ability to change flow to mask what other symptoms that they may have experiencing. And the next step, I think, for helping these patients is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
And that's what's been done in Tandis as well, and that's probably the next step to really give the best outcomes for these patients.
That's a fascinating analogy to me, and I think that, you know, as clinicians, oftentimes we struggle to understand disease processes. We struggle to make sense out of the suffering that the patient's feeling based on our physical examinations, and therefore we write off the disease, or we put aside the patient population as somehow being fundamentally flawed, rather than trying to, I guess, understand the full manifestations of the disease process and look for therapies beyond what we can offer in our practice. I mean, I always say it always comes back to collaboration, you know, when we're trying to figure out a difficult problem, the solution is usually in collaboration, and I think we've had a lot more success in treating tinnitus in centers that use these kind of multidisciplinary collaborations.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think, you know, the clinician also just has to be patient. These are, you know, these are patients that have, you know, been tossed around physician to physician, and, you know, they have a lot of concerns that can take up more time than physicians.
They absolutely do. And let's face it, when we see one of these patients on our schedule, we know that they're going to take more time away from our office practice. And in this day and age of just those resources, the time that we have allocated to see patients in clinic, this is a patient population that many would just as soon avoid.
Yeah, exactly. So when you kind of hear the alarming symptoms, you just got to listen quick, you know, listen and, you know, put the test to order. That's what I do. I think I spend almost the same amount of time I do with a new patient. I give them the questionnaire, I do the cotton test, and I validate their symptoms easily with those kind of subjective objective measures.
Yeah.
And I can keep the visit to relatively normal time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think validation of patient suffering is really important. I mean, patients want to know that we are hearing them. And this disorder, at least to anyone who practices in the field of rhinology, this certainly shouldn't be new to anyone. It's a matter of how do we advance, I guess, our knowledge and our treatment of this. Can you talk briefly about your experience with augmentation of the inferior turbinates? Are you doing that routinely now, and what type of technique would you utilize?
These are all the techniques I've adapted from Dr. Nyack. He does a whole lot of them, and I've gotten to see various ways that he's done it. One way is really just elevating that tissue off the inferior medial wall, the lateral wall. He puts alloderm in there. Things that have been adapted since is even biodesign or even cadaveric bone chips to recreate the inferior turbinate. And those are all more of a permanent option.
Mm-hmm.
If you have like a patient who is potentially in empty nose syndrome, you're not sure and you don't want to put more of a permanent option in there, you can do hyaluronic acid injections into that area and see how their symptoms improve within the next couple of months and have them come back and report back to you.
Right. And this is usually, this augmentation, it's done at the very anterior aspect of the inferior turbinate in particular?
Well, it most of the time is. However, you know, clinically what you do is you use the cotton test and you kind of put it where you think it's going to be and where they have better improvement. And then clinically, I mean, in the operating room, you perform that procedure where you had a positive cotton test.
Got it. And that brings up another maybe pearl in this is that a lot of us over the years have learned that if you need to resect the inferior turbinate for whatever reason, it's very nice to be able to leave that anterior head of the inferior turbinate, and it's very possible to do, even in some very large tumors of the inferior turbinate, inferior meatus, maxillary sinus. The inverting papilloma comes to mind, the inverting papilloma that's attached to the anterior face of the maxillary sinus, and is difficult to access, and often a medial endoscopic medial maxillectomy approach is utilized, saving that just anterior head of the inferior turbinate can really save patients from these types of symptoms. Does that jive with your experience?
Yeah, it's that anterior head is so vital. Computational flow dynamic studies have shown that anterior head warms up the nose so well. It redistributes the airflow. It's so vital to the function of the nose, that anterior aspect for sure.
Okay, great. Any other aspects of your study that you think our listeners would really need to know?
The study does show association. It doesn't show the chicken-egg aspect, but I do think we're going to have a paper coming out soon that really describes that these patients have a reversible psychological burden following inferior turbinate augmentation. And I think
you're
going to see some great results.
Yeah, and you mentioned a couple of people, Stephen Hauser, who's, I think, really been a national leader on this front, and then Jaykar Nayak, who's one of your co-authors and really has done some amazing work as well, and now here you are working and collaborating with them. So I really applaud you for that and wish you guys the greatest of success. I'm certain that there will be more publications coming out of this, and I hope to be able to have you back on the podcast so that we can see where we're going with this disorder and how we're helping patients, how we're not helping patients, and what we need to do to advance the field to yet another level.
Well, definitely, Tull. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. Take care of yourself and good luck with your future work.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.